as grey as his eyes. But the top, the future, would hold a brilliant storm of colour, azure and cinnamon, blinding white and yellow gold, and the shell pink of Svitogor blood. So he hoped, so he dreamed, that in the course of time, grain by grain, the grey would give way to the dream, and the sands of his life would run bright. Now the bird, the presence of magic, and something beyond the reach of understanding. An affinity, a resonance. It felt like the turn of a page and a story just beginning. There was the faintest glimmer of familiarity in it, as though he knew the story, but had forgotten it. And at that moment, for no reason he could put into words, the hourglass shattered. No more the cool grey sift of days, the diligent waiting for the future to trickle forth. Laszlo's dream was spilled out into the air, the colour and storm of it no longer a future to be reached, but a cyclone here and now. He didn't know what, but as surely as one feels the sting of shards when an hourglass tips off a shelf and smashes, he knew that something was happening. Right now. Chapter 8. Tizercane. Soldiers and carriage clattered through the gates. The royal entourage was always a gorgeous spectacle. But that wasn't what stopped Laszlo's feet, as abruptly as though his soul had flown on ahead of his body and left it stranded. It hadn't, surely, though maybe it leaned forward like a craned neck. A craned soul. Such absolute, unjaded wonder he had never experienced in his life. Warriors. That was the only word for the men who rode behind the queen. They were not of Zosma. Even at war, soldiers of the crown hardly merited that term, which belonged to ancient battles and blood-curdling cries. It belonged to men like this, in tusked helms and bronze chest plates, with axes strapped across their backs. They towered. Their mounts were unnaturally tall. Their mounts were unnatural. They weren't horses. They were creatures never seen before, lithe and grand and complicated. Their long necks folded back like egrets. Their legs were sleek and many-jointed, their faces deer-like, with great dark eyes and ears like sheaves of snowy feathers. And then there were their antlers, huge and branching, with a sheen like the play of prisms of warm gold. Lys. The antlers were spectralis, because the creatures were spectrals. Among all those gathered and gathering, only Laszlo recognized the white stags of the unseen city, and only he knew the warriors for who they were. Tizercane, he whispered. Tizercane, alive. The implications were profound. If they were alive, then the city was too. Not a hint or rumor in 200 years, and now Tizercane warriors were riding through the gates of the Great Library. In the sheer, shimmering improbability of the moment, it seemed to Laszlo that his dream had tired of waiting and had simply come to find him. There were a score of the warriors. The tusks on their helms were the fangs of rabbits, and the cages at their belts held scorpions. And they were not all men. A closer look revealed that their bronze chest plates were sculpted in realistic relief, and while half had square pectorals and small nipples, the other half were full-breasted, the metal etched around the navel with the Elilith tattoo given to all women of the unseen city when they reached their fertility. But this went unnoticed in the first thrilling moment of their arrival. All attention was arrested by the man who rode vanguard. Unlike the others, he was unhelmed and unarmored, more human for being unhidden, but no less striking for it. He was neither young nor old, his wild black hair just beginning to grey at his brow. His face was square and brown and leathered by much sun, his eyes jet-chips set in smiling squints. There was a stunning vitality to him, as though he breathed all the world's air and only left enough for others by sheer benevolence. He was powerful, chest fully twice as deep as a normal man's, shoulders twice as broad. Great golden bands caught his sleeves in the dip between biceps and deltoids, and his neck was dark with obscure tattoos. Instead of a chest plate, he wore a vest of tawny fur, and a broad and battered sword belt from which hung two long blades. Ereshtek, thought Laszlo, and his hands closed around the phantom hilts of Appelbau swords. He felt the texture of them, their precise weight and balance as he twirled them over his head. The memories flooded him. It had been 15 years, but it might have been 15 minutes, since his 100 routed foes fled through the frost. Long ago, when he was still wild, when he was powerful. He scanned the sky but saw no sign of the ghostly bird. The courtyard was dead silent, save for the hooves of the horses. The spectrals made no sound, moving with dancer's grace. A footman opened the carriage door, and, when the queen appeared in it, Master Elamaya, head of the Scholars Guild and director of the Great Library, took her hand and helped her down. He was a big, swaggering man with a thunderous voice, but he blanched before the new arrivals, at a loss for words. And then, from the direction of the Chrysoposium, came the ring of boot heels, the long, sure stride. A wave of heads turned toward the sound. Laszlo didn't have to look. Everything clicked into place. The requisition of his books made sudden sense, and he understood that Thion would not have burned them or flown the pages off the widow's walk like birds. He would have known of this extraordinary visit in advance. He would have read them. He would have prepared. Of course. He came into view, walking briskly. He paused to kiss the hand of his godmother, and offered a brief bow to Master Elamaya, before turning to the Tizercane, as though he were the library's representative, and not the older man.
"As a merit, Errol Fane," he said,
his voice smooth and strong.
"Honora enet en shamir."
"Well met, Errol Fane. Your presence is our honor." Laszlo heard it as though from a distance. It was the traditional greeting of guests in Unseen, learned, word for word, from his books. It had taken him years to develop a working dictionary of Unseen, and more to unlock the probable pronunciation of its alphabet. Years. And Thion stood there and spoke that phrase, as though it were just lying around, knowable, as common as any pebble picked up off the ground, rather than the rare and precious gem it was. The warrior, Errol Fane, Thion had called him, was amazed to find himself greeted in his own language, and immediately responded in kind. "And your welcome is our blessing," was what he said. Laszlo understood. It was the first Unseen he had ever heard from a native speaker, and it sounded just as he'd always imagined it would. Like calligraphy, if calligraphy were written in honey. If Laszlo had understood his words, though, Thion did not. He covered well, spouting a pleasantry before shifting into common tongue to say,
"This is a day such as dreams are made of. I never thought to set eyes on a Tizercane warrior."
"I see it's true, what they say of the great library of Zosma,"
Errol Fane replied, shifting to common tongue as well. His accent on its smooth syllables was like a patina on bronze.
"That the wind is in your employ, and blows all the world's knowledge to your door."
Thion laughed, quite at ease.
"If only it were so simple. No, it's a good deal more work than that. But if it is knowable, I dare say it is known here. And if it is half as fascinating as your history, then it is also savored."
Errol Fane dismounted, and another warrior followed suit. A tall, straight woman who stood like a shadow to him. The rest remained mounted, and their faces weren't impassive like the ranks of Zosma soldiers. They were as vivid, each one, as their generals. sharp with interest and alive. It made a marked difference. The Zosma guards were like mounted statues, eyes blank and fixed on nothing. They might have been minted, not born. But the Tizerkane looked back at the scholars looking at them, and the faces framed by rabid fangs, though fierce, were also fascinated. Avid, even hopeful, and above all, human. It was jarring. It was wonderful.
"This is not the first stop on our sojourn,"
Errol Fane said, his voice like rough music.
"But it is the first in which we have been greeted with familiar words. I came seeking scholars, but had not anticipated that we might ourselves be a subject of scholarly interest."
"How could you doubt it, sir?" said Thion, all sincerity. "Your city has been my fascination since I was 5 years old, playing Tizerkane in the orchard, and felt its name plucked from my mind."
Sometimes a moment is so remarkable that it carves out a space in time and spins there, while the world rushes on around it. This was one such. Laszlo stood stunned, a white noise roaring in his ears. Without his books, his room felt like a body with its hearts cut out. Now his body felt like a body with its hearts cut out. There was more. The Queen and Master Elamaya joined in. Laszlo heard it all. The concern and abiding interest they took in the far, fabled city and its mysteries, and with what excitement they had met the news of this visit. They were convincing. No one listening would suspect they hadn't given Weep a moment's thought until a few weeks ago. No doubt the assembled scholars were wondering how they could have been ignorant of such deep and long-standing interest on the part of their guildmaster and monarch, who, it was to be noted by the keen-eyed among them, wore a priceless new tiara of Lys atop her stiff, graying curls.
"So, sir,"
said Master Elamaya, perhaps trying to wrest authority from Thion.
"What news of Weep?"
A misstep. The warrior was stoic, but couldn't entirely hide his wince, as though the name caused him physical pain.
"I've never liked to call it that,"
cut in Thion, softly like a confession.
"It's bitter on my tongue. I think of it as the Unseen City instead."
It was another knife in Laszlo's hearts, and earned Thion a considering look from Errol Fane.
"We don't use that name, either," he said.
"Then what do you call it?"
inquired the Queen, querulous.
"We call it home, Your Majesty."
"And you're a long way from it,"
observed Thion, getting to the point.
"You must be wondering why."
"I confess I am, and so much else besides. I welcome you to our great city of learning, and hope that we may be of service."
"As do I," said the warrior. "More than you could know."
They went inside, and Laszlo could only watch them go. There was a sensation in his heart, though, as a stirring of embers. There was fire in him. It wasn't smothered, only banked. But it would burn like the wings of the seraphim before this was over. Chapter 9. A Rare Opportunity. Word spread quickly. The visitor wished to address the scholars.
"What can he want?"
they wondered, streaming into the royal theatre. Attendance was voluntary and unanimous. If the sight of the warriors wasn't enough to stoke their curiosity, there was rumour of a rare opportunity. They gossiped, taking their seats.
"They say he brought a coffer of gemstones the size of a dowry chest."
"And did you see the tiara? It's Lys."
"Did you see the creatures? One rack of antlers could ransom a kingdom."
"Just try getting close to one."
"The warriors!"
"Some are women."
"Of all the mad indecencies!"
but mostly they wondered at the man himself.
They say he's a hero of some kind,
Laszlo overheard.
The liberator of Weep.
Liberator? From who?
Who or what?
Was the cryptic reply.
I don't know, but he's called the Godslayer.
Everything else in Laszlo's mind took a step back to clear space for this new intelligence.
The Godslayer.
He marveled. What had the warrior slain that went by the name of God? For 15 years, the mysteries of Weep had never been far from his thoughts. For 7 years, he had scoured the library for clues of what had happened there. And now here were Tysakane. And the answers he sought were under this very roof, and new questions too.
What were they doing here?
In spite of Nero's treachery, a dazzlement was growing in him.
A rare opportunity.
Could it be what he hoped? What if it was? In all his dreaming, and indeed all his despairing, he had never foreseen this. That his impossible dream might simply ride through the gates. He didn't take a seat in the sea of scarlet robes, but stood in the back of the theater, in the shadows. Scholars had been summoned, not librarians, and he didn't want to risk being told to leave. Errol Fane took the stage. A hush fell fast. Many of the scholars were seeing him for the first time, and you could almost feel their carefully cultivated skepticism fail. If there were gods in need of slaying, here was the man for the job. Laszlo's pulse thrilled through him as the Godslayer began.
It has been 2 centuries since my city lost the world,
the warrior said.
And was lost to it. Someday that story will be told, but not today. Today it is enough to say that we have passed through a long, dark time, and come out of it alive and strong. Our difficulties are now behind us. All but one.
He paused. A somberness darkened his voice and regard. The mysteries of Weep writ on its own hero's face.
The shadow of our dark time still haunts us. It poses no danger. That much I can say. There is nothing to fear, I assure you.
Here he paused, and Laszlo leaned forward, hardly breathing.
Why did he assure them?
What did their fear matter?
Could he mean?
You may know, he went on, that my city was ever forbidden to Ferengi. Outsiders, as we would call you.
He smiled a little and added,
fondly, of course.
And a low laugh rippled through the audience.
You may also have heard that Ferengi who insisted on trying their luck were executed, one and all.
The laughter ceased.
I am grateful to your good queen for giving us a gentler reception here.
Laughter again, if hesitant. It was his manner, the warmth of him, like steam rising from tea. One looked at him and thought, here is a great man, and also a good one, though few men are ever both.
No one born this side of the El Muthaleth has ever seen what lies beyond it. But that is about to change.
A rushing filled Laszlo's ears, but he didn't miss a word.
I have come to extend an invitation, to visit my city as my personal guest. This last remaining problem we have been unable to solve on our own. Our library and university were crushed 200 years ago. Literally crushed, you understand. And our wisdom keepers with them. So we find ourselves lacking the knowledge and expertise we need. Mathematics, engineering, metallurgy.
A vague gesture of his fingers indicated he spoke in broad terms.
We've come far from home to assemble a delegation of men and women.
And as he said this, his eyes sketched the crowd, as though to confirm what he had already noted, that there were no women among the scholars of Zosma. A furrow creased his brow, but he went on.
Who might supply what we lack, and help us to put the last specter of the past where it belongs?
He looked out at them, letting his eyes settle on individual faces. And Laszlo, who was accustomed to the near invisibility his insignificance bestowed on him, was jolted to feel the weight of that gaze on himself. A second or two it rested there, a blaze of connection, the feeling of being seen and set apart.
And if this chance in itself,
Errol Fane continued,
does not tempt you to disrupt your life and work, for a year at least, more likely two, rest assured you will be well compensated. Further, for the one who solves the problem,
his voice was rich with promise,
the reward will be great.
With that, most every scholar in Zosma was ready to pack a trunk and strike out for the Almuthaleth. But that wasn't to be the way of it. It was not an open invitation, the Godslayer went on to say. He would select the delegates himself based on their qualifications. Their qualifications. The words flattened Laszlo like a sudden shift in gravity. He didn't need to be told that dreamer was not a qualification. It wasn't enough to want it more than anyone else. The Godslayer hadn't come halfway around the world to grant a junior librarian's dream. He'd come seeking knowledge and expertise. And Laszlo couldn't imagine that meant a Ferengi expert on his own city. Mathematics, engineering, metallurgy, he'd said. He'd come for practical knowledge. He'd come for men like Thion Nero. Chapter 10. No Story Yet Told. The Godslayer was 2 days interviewing scholars at the Great Library of Zosma, and in the end, he invited only three to join his delegation. They were a mathematician, a natural philosopher, and, to no one's surprise, the alchemist, Thion Nero. Laszlo wasn't even granted an interview. It wasn't Errol Fane who denied him, but Master Elamaya, who was overseeing the process.
Well, what is it?
He asked, impatient, when Laszlo reached the front of the queue.
Do you have a message for someone?
What? No, said Laszlo. I'd like an interview, please.
You? An interview? I hardly think he's recruiting librarians, boy.
There were other scholars around, and they added their own mockery.
Don't you know, Elamaya? Strange isn't just a librarian. He's practically a scholar himself. Of fairy tales.
I'm sorry to say,
the master told Laszlo, eyes heavy-lidded with disdain,
that Errol Fane made no mention of fairies.
Maybe they've an elf problem in Weep, said another. Do you know anything about elf trapping, Strange?
Or dragons. Perhaps it's dragons.
This went on for some time.
I'd just like the chance to speak with him,
Laszlo pleaded, but to no avail. Master Elamaya wouldn't
waste their guests' time
by sending in someone so manifestly unqualified. And Laszlo couldn't find it in himself to argue on his own behalf. He was unqualified. The fact was, if he did get in to see the Godslayer, he didn't even know what he would say. What could he say to recommend himself? I know a lot of stories. It was the first time he ever felt, for himself, a measure of the contempt others felt for him. Who had ever expended so much passion on a dream? Only to stand helpless as it was granted to others. Others, moreover, who had expended no passion on it at all. His impossible dream had, against all probability, crossed deserts and mountains to come to Zosma and extend an unprecedented invitation. But not to him.
"I owe you a thank you, Strange,"
said Thion Nero later, after everything was decided and the Tysocain were preparing to depart. Laszlo could only look at him, blank. A thank you for what? For helping him when he was desperate and alone? For handing him the secret to his fame and fortune? For rescuing the royal treasury and enabling Zosma to pay its army and avoid war? No, none of that.
"Your books were quite informative," he said. "Of course, I imagine real scholars will take an interest in Weep Now, and amateur records won't be needed. Still, it's not bad work. You should be proud."
Proud. Laszlo remembered that solitary thank you from back when they were boys, and couldn't believe that it had ever been meaningful.
"What are you doing here?" he asked. "Shouldn't you be over there with the Chosen?"
The Tysocain were mounted, spectrals gleaming white and lis, the warriors in their bronze, faces fierce and alive. Errol Fain was bidding the Queen farewell, and the mathematician and natural philosopher were with them too. The Chosen scholars weren't leaving with the Tysocain today. They were to meet them in 4 months' time, at the caravansary in Alkenost, where the full delegation would assemble to strike out together across the Elmutheleth. It would take them time to wrap up their work and prepare themselves for a long journey. None of them were adventurers, at least not yet. In the meantime, the Tysocain would continue their travels, searching out more delegates in the kingdoms of Syriza, Thanagost, and Myelin. Still, Laszlo didn't know what Thion was doing mingling among the Unchosen, besides gloating.
"Oh, I'm going," he said. "I just wanted you to know that your books were helpful.
Errol Fain was most impressed with my knowledge of his city. Do you know, he said I was the first outsider he's met who knew anything about it. Isn't that a fine thing?" Fine wasn't the word that came to Laszlo's mind.
"Anyway," continued Thion, "I didn't want you to worry that you'd done all that work for nothing."
And Laszlo wasn't a creature of anger or envy, but he felt the scorch of both, as though his veins were fuses and they were burning through him, leaving paths of ash in their wake.
"Why do you even want to go?" he asked, bitter. "It's nothing to you."
Thion shrugged. Everything about him was smooth. His pressed clothes and perfect shave, his cavalier voice and blithe expression.
"Stories will be told about me, Strange. You should appreciate that. There ought to be adventure in them, don't you think? It's a dull legend that takes place in a laboratory."
A legend? The tale of the golden godson who distilled Azoth and saved kingdoms. It was all about him, and not Weep at all. He smacked Laszlo on the back.
"I'd better go and say goodbye.
And don't worry, Strange. You'll get your books back." It was no comfort. For years, Laszlo's books had represented his dream. Now they would represent the end of it.
"Don't be so glum," said Thion. "Some day I'll come home, and when I do, I promise."
He put a hand to his hearts.
"I'll tell you all about the mysteries of Weep."
Numbly, Laszlo watched him walk away. It wasn't fair. He knew it was a childish thought. Who knew better than he that life wasn't fair? He'd learned that lesson before he could walk, before he could speak. But how could he accept this? How could he go on from this, knowing that his chance had come and gone, and he hadn't even been allowed to try? He imagined marching forth right now, right here, in front of everyone, and appealing directly to Errol Fain. The thought made his face burn and his voice wither, and he might as well have been turned to stone. Master Hurricane found him there, and laid a consoling hand on his arm.
I know it's hard, Strange, but it will pass. Some men are born for great things, and others to help great men do great things. There's no shame in it.
Laszlo could have laughed. What would Master Hyrcan say if he knew the help that Laszlo had already given the great golden godson? What would everyone say, those scholars who'd mocked him, if they knew a fairy tale had held the key to Azoth? When Laszlo had gone to Thion with his miracle for breakfast, it had been so clearly Thion's story that he hadn't even considered keeping it for himself. But this was his story. He was Strange the Dreamer, and this was his dream. "I do want to help a great man do great things," he told the librarian. "I want to help Errol Fane. I want to help the Unseen City."
"My boy," said Master Hyrcan,
with deep and gentle sadness,
"how could you help?"
And Laszlo didn't know how, but he knew one thing. He couldn't help if he stayed here. He watched Errol Fane bid Thion farewell. The scene dazzled. Royalty and warriors and spectacular beasts. Errol Fane stepped a foot up into his stirrup and mounted. Thion stood beside him, a perfect part of a perfect picture. Some people were born to inhabit such scenes. That was what Master Hyrcan believed, and what Laszlo had always been taught. And others were born to... what? To stand in the crowd and do nothing, try nothing, say nothing, and accept every serving of bitter nothing as their due. No. Just... no.
"Wait! Please!"
The words came from him. Here, in front of everyone. His heartbeats were deafening. His head felt wrapped in thunder. The scholars craned their necks to see who among them had spoken, and were startled, even astonished, to see the soft-spoken, dreamy-eyed junior librarian cutting his way through the crowd. He was astonished himself, and stepped forth with a sense of unreality. Errol Fane had heard him and was looking back, inquiring. Laszlo had lost track of his feet and legs. He might have been floating for all he could tell, but he supposed it more likely he was walking and just couldn't feel it. This boldness, such as it was, went against everything in him. But this was it, his last chance. Act now, or lose his dream forever. He forced himself forward.
"My name is Laszlo Strange,"
he called out, and the full complement of Tyzicane warriors turned their heads as one to look at him. Their vivid faces showed their surprise. Not because Laszlo had called out, but because he had called out in Unseen. And unlike Thion, he didn't treat it like a common thing. But the rare and precious gem it was. The words, in the reverent tones of his rough voice, sounded like a magic spell.
"Might I beg a moment of your time?"
he asked, still in their tongue. And he must not have looked crazed, though it had to be a near thing. He felt crazed, because Errol Fane eased his spectral around to face him, and, with a nod, signalled him to approach.
"Who is that?"
Laszlo heard the Queen ask, her voice waspish.
"What is he saying?"
Thion stepped forward, his eyes darting between Laszlo and Errol Fane.
"Sir,"
he said quickly, his veneer of smoothness slipping.
"You needn't trouble yourself. He's only a librarian."
Errol Fane's brow creased.
"Only?"
he asked. If Thion had indeed read the complete works of Laszlo Strange, then he must know that in Weep of Old, the keepers of books had been the keepers of wisdom, and not servants as they were in Zosma. Realizing that his slight had missed its mark, he hurried to say,
"I only mean that he lacks the sort of expertise you're looking for."
"I see," said Errol Fane,
turning his attention back to Laszlo. And then, in his own tongue, with what seemed to Laszlo's untrained ear to be slow and careful enunciation, he inquired,
"And what can I do for you, young man?"
Laszlo's grasp of the spoken language was tenuous, but he managed to answer in uncertain grammar.
"I want to come with you. Please, let me be of service."
Errol Fane's surprise showed.
"And why did you not come to me before?"
"I wasn't permitted, sir," Laszlo said.
"I see," said Errol Fane once more,
and Laszlo thought he detected displeasure in his tone.
"Tell me, how did you learn our language?"
Haltingly, Laszlo did.
I built a key with old trade documents. It was a place to start. Then there were letters, books.
What could he say? How could he convey the hours, hundreds of hours, spent bent over ledgers, his eyes swimming in the dim light of a dull glaive, while his mind traced the arabesques and coils of an alphabet that looked like music sounded? How could he explain that it had fit his mind as nothing else ever had, like numbers to a mathematician, or air to a flute? He couldn't. He only said,
"It's taken me 7 years."
Errol Fane took all this in, casting a mild sideward glance at Thion Nero, who was stiff with alarm, and if he was comparing the alchemist's superficial knowledge with Laszlo's deeper understanding, he didn't call it out.
"And why have you learned it?"
he asked Laszlo, who stumbled through a reply. He wasn't sure exactly what he said, but he tried to say,
"Because your city is my fascination. I can still taste its true name. And I know magic is real, because I felt it that day, and all I've ever wanted is to go and find it."
"Find magic? Or my city?"
"Your city," said Laszlo. "Both. Though magic..."
He groped for words, and ended up shifting in frustration back to common tongue.
"I fear that magic must be dark," he said. "To have done such a thing as erase a name. That has been my only experience of it. Well," he added, "until the white bird."
"What?"
The Godslayer grew suddenly serious.
"What white bird?"
The ghost eagle," said Laszlo. "Is it not yours? It arrived with you, so I thought it must be."
"She's here?"
Errol Fane asked, intent. He searched the sky, the line of the rooftops.
"When did you see her? Where?"
"Her?"
Laszlo pointed beyond the palace.
"When you were first coming up the road," he said, she seemed to be following. She vanished right before my eyes."
"Please, Strange,"
Thion cut in, pained.
"What are you on about? Vanishing birds?"
He laughed, as one would at a child with a silly notion, but it rang terribly false.
"Now I really must insist you leave our guest in peace. Step back now, and you might yet keep your position."
Laszlo faced him. The alchemist's hand rested, casually, on the hilt of his sword. But there was nothing casual in the malice that burned in his gaze. It wasn't only malice, but fear. And Laszlo understood two things. He would not keep his position, not after such insolence as this. And he could not be permitted to leave, either, not with the secret he carried. In putting himself forward, he had risked everything. It was all suddenly very clear. A weird, bright courage sang in him as he turned back to Errol Fane.
"Sir,"
he said,
"it's true that I am unqualified in engineering and the sciences, but I can be of use to you. No one would work harder, I promise you. I could be your secretary, handle contracts for the delegates, write letters, keep accounts, anything. Or I'll take care of the spectrals, carry water, whatever you need. I...
He wasn't fully in possession of himself. His words were spilling out. His mind was racing. Who am I? He asked himself. What do I have to offer? And before he could bite it back, he heard himself say,
I can tell stories. I know a lot of stories.
Before faltering into a painful silence.
I know a lot of stories.
Had he really just said that? Thion Nero laughed. Errol Fane didn't. He exchanged a look with his second in command, the tall, straight woman by his side. Laszlo couldn't read it. He saw that she was beautiful, in a very different way than the women of Zosma were beautiful. She was unpainted and unsmiling. There were lines around her eyes from laughter, and around her mouth from grief. She didn't speak, but something passed between the two. These seconds were the longest of Laszlo's life, and the heaviest with fate. If they left him behind, would he even last the day? What would Nero do to him, and when? Then Errol Fane cleared his throat.
It's been a very long time since we heard new stories, he said. And I could indeed use a secretary. Gather your things. You'll come with us now.
Laszlo's throat trapped his breath. His knees felt turned to water. What had been holding him up all this time? Whatever it was, it let go, and it was all he could do not to stumble. Everyone was watching. Everyone was listening. The shocked hush was threaded with murmurs.
I have nothing to gather, he breathed.
It was true. But even if he'd had a palace full of possessions, he couldn't have gone to fetch them now, for fear of returning to find the Tizercane gone, and his chance, and his dream, and his life with them.
Well then, up with you, said Errol Fane, and a spectral was led forward.
A spectral? For him?
This is Lyxa, said the warrior,
putting the reins into Laszlo's hand, as though he might know what to do with them. He'd never even ridden a horse, let alone a creature like this. He stood there looking at the reins, and the stirrup, and the faces of the Tizercane regarding him with curiosity. He was used to hiding behind books or in the shadows. It was midsummer, mid-morning, in the full light of day. There were no books to hide behind, and no shadows. Only Laszlo Strange, in his worn grey robes, with his nose that had been broken by fairy tales, looking like the hero of no story ever told. Or, no story yet told. He mounted. He was clumsy, and he wasn't dressed for riding. But he got a leg across, and that seemed to be the main thing. His robes hiked up to his knees. His legs were pale, and his soft-soled slippers were worn nearly through. Lyxa knew her business, and followed when the others filed out through the gate. All eyes were on Laszlo, and all were wide, except for Thion's, which were narrow with fury.
You can keep the books,
Laszlo told him, and left him standing there. He took one last look at the gathered crowd, scarlet robes and the occasional grey, and spotted Master Hurricane, looking stunned and proud. Laszlo nodded to the old man, the only person besides Thion who knew what this meant to him, and the only person in the world who might be happy for him. And he nearly wept.
I'm going to weep, he thought,
and could have laughed at the pun. But he kept his composure. And when the Tizercane warriors rode out of the great library and out of Zosma, Strange the Dreamer went with them.
Chapter 11 Twelfth Moon.
That was sixth moon, summer in the north. It was twelfth moon now, and winter in Zosma, the Ada frozen over,
and young men perchance composing poems to girls they'd met ice skating. Laszlo Strange was not among them. He was riding a spectral at the head of a long, undulating line of camels. Behind them lay all the emptiness of the known world. Flat sky above, flat earth below, and between the two, nothing at all for hundreds of miles, save the name Elmutheleth for parched lips to curse. The months of travel had altered him. His library pallor had burned and then browned. His muscles had hardened, his hands grown calloused. He felt himself toughened, like meat hung to cure. And though he hadn't seen his reflection for weeks, he had no doubt that Master Hurricane would be satisfied.
"A man should have squint lines from looking at the horizon," the old librarian had said. "Not just from reading in dim light."
Well, here was the horizon Laszlo had dreamed of since he was 5 years old. Ahead, at last, lay the desert's hard and final edge, the cusp. Jagged and glittering, it was a long, low-slung formation of blinding white rock, and a perfect natural battlement for that which lay beyond. Not yet visible, and never before seen by Ferengi eyes, lay the city that had lost its name, and, within it, whatever problem the Godslayer sought help to solve. It was the first week of Twelfth Moon on the far side of the Elmutheleth, and Strange the Dreamer, library stowaway and scholar of fairy tales, had never been thirstier or more full of wonder. Part 2. Thakra. Noun. The precise point on the spectrum of awe at which wonder turns to dread, or dread to wonder. Archaic. From the ecstatic priestesses of Thakra, worshippers of the seraphim, whose ritual dance expressed the dualism of beauty and terror. Chapter 12. Kissing Ghosts.
"You can kiss a ghost. I suppose you'd know."
"I do know. It's just like kissing a person."
"Now, that's something you wouldn't know."
Sarai lingered in the half-light of the gallery, listening to the rhythms of Sparrow and Ruby arguing. It never grew very heated between them, but neither did it ever quite abate. She knew that as soon as she stepped out into the garden, they would draw her into it, and she wasn't awake enough for that. It was late afternoon. She'd only just risen, and it took her some time to shake off the effects of Lull, the draught she drank to help her sleep. Well, she didn't need help sleeping. Her nights were long and filled with dark work. She was exhausted by dawn, and drifted off as soon as she let her eyes shut. But she didn't let them shut until she'd had her lull, because lull kept her from dreaming. Sarai didn't dream. She didn't dare.
"I've kissed people," said Ruby. "I've kissed you. Pecks on the cheek don't count,"
replied Sparrow. Sarai could see the pair of them, shimmering in the late-day sun. Sparrow had just turned 16, and Ruby would in a few more months. Like Sarai, they wore silk slips that would have been considered undergarments if there were anyone around to see them. Anyone alive, that is. They were picking plums, their two sets of bare arms reaching in among the whip-like boughs, their two dark heads turned away from her, one tidy, the other wild as wind. The wild one was Ruby. She refused to wear her hair in braids, and then acted as though she were dying when they tried to brush out the tangles. Sarai gathered, from the tenor of the debate, that she had been kissing the ghosts. She sighed. It wasn't a surprise, exactly. Of the five of them, Ruby was the most ardent, and the most prone to boredom.
"It's easy for you,"
she told Sarai just the other evening.
"You get to see people every night. You get to live. The rest of us are just stuck in here with the ghosts."
Sarai hadn't argued. It would seem that way to the others, of course. She did see the people of Weep every night, but it made nothing easier. On the contrary, every night she bore witness to what she could never have. It wasn't living. It was torture.
"Good, you're awake,"
said Farrell, coming into the gallery. It was a long, vaulted arcade that overlooked the garden from the dexter arm of the citadel, and was where dinner would soon be laid out for the five of them. Here, the slick blue mesartheum of which the entire citadel was constructed was softened almost to an afterthought by Sparrow's orchids. Hundreds of them, dozens of varieties, spiking, trailing, billowing. They dressed the colonnade in a forest of blooms. Vines wrapped the pillars, and epiphytes clung to the ceiling like anemones or roosting butterflies. It was sumptuous, illusory. You could almost forget where you were. You could almost imagine yourself free and walking in the world. Almost. As for Farrell, he was Sarai's ally and fellow acting parent to the other three. He was 17 years old, like her, and had this year fallen almost all the way over the line into adulthood. He was tall, still lean from his fast growth, and had begun to shave. Or, as Sparrow put it, to
abuse his poor face with knives.
It was true he hadn't yet mastered the art, but he was getting better. Sarai saw no new wounds on him, only the healing pucker of an old one on the sharp edge of his jaw. She thought he looked tired.
"Bad day?"
she asked. The girls weren't always easy to manage, and since Sarai was nocturnal by necessity, it mostly fell to Farrell to see that they did their chores and obeyed the rule.
"Not bad," said Farrell. "Just long."
It was odd for Sarai to think of days being long. She slept through them all, from sunrise nearly till sunset, and it always felt as though she were opening her eyes only a moment after closing them. It was the lull. It ate her days in one grey gulp.
"How about you?"
he asked, his brown eyes soft with concern.
"Bad night?"
All of Sarai's nights were bad. Bad seemed to her the very nature of night.
"Just long,"
she echoed with a rueful smile, laying one hand to her slender neck and rolling her head from side to side. She knew he couldn't understand. He did his part to keep the five of them alive, and she did hers. There was no point complaining.
"Where's Minya?"
she asked, noting the absence of the fifth member of their peculiar family. Farrell shrugged.
"I haven't seen her since breakfast. Maybe she's with Great Ellen."
Great Ellen had run the Citadel nursery before the carnage. Now she ran everything. Well, everything that was still running, which wasn't much.
"Ghost kisser,"
they heard from the garden. Sparrow's soft voice curled with laughter, and was cut off by an
"Ow!"
as Ruby pelted her with a plum.
"Who was it?"
Sarai asked Farrell.
"Who did she aim her lips at?"
Farrell made a sound that was the verbal equivalent of a shrug.
"Kem, I think." "Really? Kem?"
Sarai wrinkled her nose. Kem had been with them since the beginning. He'd been a footman before the carnage, and still wore the livery he'd died in, which to Sarai's mind suggested a distinct lack of imagination.
"Why?"
Farrell asked Sarai, waggling his eyebrows.
"Who would you kiss?"
In a tone both arch and light, Sarai replied,
"I kiss dozens of people every night."
And she touched a spot just above the outer curve of one cinnamon eyebrow.
"Right here. Men and women, babies and grandparents. I kiss them and they shudder."
Her voice was like ice, and so were her hearts.
"I kiss them and they grieve."
"That's not kissing," said Farrell. He had been teasing Mary, and now he wasn't. He was right, of course. It was not kissing, what Sarai did to people in the deep of night.
"Maybe not," she said. Still arch, still light. But it's as close as I'll ever come to it.
She pushed down her shoulders and lifted her chin. End of discussion, her posture said. Ferrell looked like he might press the issue, but all of a sudden Ruby's voice grew louder.
Well, let's just see about it, shall we?
She said, followed shortly by a sing-song call of,
Ferrell, where are you?
Ferrell froze like prey in a raptor's shadow.
Oh, no, he said.
Ruby appeared in an arch of the arcade, looking like one more orchid in the forest, her slim form a stem upholding a bloom of riotous hair. Ferrell tried to melt out of sight, but it was too late. She'd spotted him.
There you are. Oh, hello, Sarai. Hope you slept well. Ferrell, I need you for a second.
Sparrow was right behind her.
You do not need him, she said. Leave him alone.
And the chain of events that followed was a perfect illustration of the minor chaos that passed for life in the Citadel. Ruby seized Ferrell by his collar and yanked his face down to hers. He struggled. She held on, mashing her lips against his, and doing something to his mouth that looked and sounded less like kissing than devouring. The temperature dropped. The air over their heads churned and darkened, a cloud coalescing out of nowhere, grey and dense and gravid with rain. Within a second, the gallery was full of the wild tang of ozone, and a fullness of moisture that made them feel they were inside a storm, even before the first drops burst forth, fat and full and very cold, like the bottom dropping out of a bucket. Sarai felt the frigid spatter, but Ruby was the target, and the girl was soaked in an instant. Her gasp freed Ferrell's lips from suction. He wrenched himself away and staggered back, glaring and wiping his mouth, which was undevoured but glistening with spit. Ruby tried to skitter clear of the cloud, but it pursued her.
Ferrell, call it off!
She cried, but he didn't, so she charged straight toward him, cloud and all. He dodged and ducked behind Sarai, into whom Ruby caromed in a plash of sodden, icy silk. It was Sarai's turn to gasp. The rain was arctic.
Ferrell!
She managed to croak. The cloud vanished as it had come, and Sarai pushed away from Ruby, shocked and streaming. Beneath her feet, the floor had become a wide, shallow lake. The orchids glistened, rivulets of rain streaming from their fleshy petals. Her own slip was wet dark and clinging to her body, and she was now thoroughly awake.
Thank you so much,
she said to Ferrell, who was still wiping the saliva off his face.
You're welcome,
he replied, surly. When they were little, they'd thought he made the clouds. And why wouldn't they? There was no one to explain it to them, or Sarai's gift to her, or the girl's gifts to them. The gods had died and left them to their own devices. Ferrell wished, and clouds appeared. Even before he'd known to wish for them, they'd come, tied to his moods and terribly inconvenient, to hear Great Ellen tell it. How many times had the nursery flooded because when this little boy was angry or excited, clouds filled the air around him? Now he could control it, more or less, and called them on purpose. Sometimes they were rain clouds, heavy and dark, and sometimes airy tufts of white that cast delicate shade and twisted into shapes like hunting rabbits or castles in the air. There was snow from time to time, always a treat, and hail, less of a treat, and sometimes sultry, muggy vapors that smelled of growth and decay. Occasionally, perilously, there was lightning. Sarai and Ferrell were 10 or 11 when a paper kite appeared with some fog, and they realized he didn't make the clouds. He ripped them out of faraway skies. He stole them. Cloud thief, they called him now, and this was his part to play in keeping them alive. The river was out of their reach, and rain was seasonal. Their only source of water for much of the year was Feral's clouds. Ruby's riot of hair had gone otter-pelt sleek, still sluicing off the remnants